From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, space is the place. A huge comet is about to crash into Jupiter. David Levy is a member of the team that discovered the comet. We'll feature a recent interview with him about the significance of the crash. Next Wednesday is the 25th anniversary of the first moonwalk. We'll hear from Alan Shepard, America's first man in space, and one of the few people who have walked on the moon. Chuck Yeager was never an astronaut, but he was the first person to break the sound barrier, which helped make space travel possible. We'll feature a 1988 interview with him. Then Stephen Schiff reviews the new Arnold Schwarzenegger movie, True Lies. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. President Clinton says Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin and Jordan's King Hussein will meet in Washington in 10 days. They hope to sign a peace agreement. The president says both leaders will address a joint meeting of Congress and attend a joint state dinner at the White House. Secretary of State Warren Christopher is going to the Middle East to help both countries clear up remaining differences. Both countries have already concluded the framework of an agreement. The USS Mount Whitney is sailing for Haitian waters. It's a vessel designed to serve as a command center in military action. Officials say no Haitian invasion is imminent, but they say it is good preparedness. Meanwhile, in Fort Bragg, North Carolina, the Army has been practicing parachute airdrop drills. NPR's David Malpas reports.
Some 2,000 paratroopers from the Army's 82nd Airborne Division at Fort Bragg, North Carolina, are rehearsing jumps for securing airfields at night. Officials describe it as routine training, but it is the kind of activity that would be used during the initial phase of any invasion. Meanwhile, Marines from Camp Lejeune, North Carolina, are readying themselves to assist the 5,000 Americans now in Haiti, should that become necessary. The Marines are practicing evacuation maneuvers on an island in the Bahamas, just 80 miles from Haiti. In another precaution, U.S. soldiers are being reminded about Haiti's voodoo tradition, with instructions not to accept any gifts or trinkets. Officials say they aren't worried about magic, but the possibility of the objects being tainted with poison. I'm David Malpas in Chapel Hill, North Carolina.
Supreme Court nominee Stephen Breyer has received praise and criticism today. Opponents of his confirmation are warning senators about his positions on consumer issues and abortion. NPR's John Greenberg reports.
The fourth day of confirmation hearings opened well for Judge Breyer. The American Bar Association gave him its highest rating for a Supreme Court justice. An ABA representative told the senators his group agreed unanimously that Breyer is well qualified. But consumer advocate Ralph Nader offered his view that Breyer leans towards the interests of big business in antitrust matters. An advocate of homeschooling said Breyer favors loose standards that would give public officials too much control over what parents may teach at home. And the group Americans United for Life said Breyer presumably favors abortion because he was nominated by President Clinton. The criticisms appear to have little effect on the senators. Republican Orrin Hatch of Utah said however much he agrees with the views of anti-abortion groups, he would not reject Breyer based on a single issue. This is John Greenberg in Washington.
Radio reports from Colombia say Marxist guerrillas have killed at least 45 soldiers in an attack in the southern jungles. The report, which hasn't been confirmed, says this is the worst attack against the army in 2 years. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up almost 9 points at 3,747. This is NPR. The rebel Rwandan Patriotic Front says it will swear in a new broad-based government on Monday in Kigali, the Rwandan capital. The rebels say they're welcoming French efforts to arrest what they call criminals in a French humanitarian zone set up for refugees. The Rwandan Hutu-dominated government, which has been nearly defeated by the rebels, still occupies embassies around the world and in the United Nations Security Council. But the United States has officially disrecognized the old government and is expected to ask the UN to review the Rwandan Security Council seat. At least 30 people have now died from the effects of Georgia flooding. A massive cleanup is underway. Some of the flooded-out residents of central and southern Georgia are returning home. Sid Hoskinson of Peach State Public Radio reports.
Georgia's rivers are expected to remain at or near flood level for the next several days. Some 40,000 Georgians were evacuated from their homes and businesses in low-lying areas. In Albany, flood-damaged bridges connecting the east and west sections of the city are finally being reopened, first to pedestrians and later to vehicles. Until today, residents had to take a 2-hour detour to get from one side of town to the other. People in Bainbridge, Georgia, are breathing a sigh of relief today after waiting all week for the Flint River to crest. When it finally did, yesterday, it rose to a flood level that was several feet lower than originally predicted. The lack of drinking water continues to be a problem for 150,000 Georgians, most of them in the Macon area. City officials there say it will be next week before running water is restored. For National Public Radio, I'm Sid Hoskinson in Georgia.
The Federal Reserve has released its industrial production report. It shows hot weather had the nation's utilities going almost full tilt. This helped push industrial production up by 0.5%. The Fed says if utilities are taken out, output was only up 0.1%. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The big event in the solar system begins tomorrow when a huge comet starts crashing into the largest planet, Jupiter. We're opening this archive edition of the show with an interview from just a couple of weeks ago with David Levy, a member of the team that discovered the comet. The comet is named after him and his partners, Carolyn and Eugene Shoemaker. Levy is an amateur astronomer who has discovered 21 comets. Comet Shoemaker-Levy has broken up into pieces that will hit Jupiter over a period of 6 days. This is the first time in history we'll be able to watch what happens when a comet strikes a planet. I asked Levy why that's such a big deal.
It's a major deal because comets have had an enormous influence in the history of the Earth and in the development of life on Earth. Comets, we think, brought the Earth's water supply here. If it weren't for a long series of comet impacts over the years, especially the early years, we probably wouldn't have any water here. Also, we think that comets brought the seeds of life to Earth, the carbon, hydrogen, oxygen, and nitrogen that are the seeds of life, the simple alphabet of life, as one scientist has said. But probably most important, a comet impact that's probably about the size of the one that's about to hit Jupiter resulted in the end of the dinosaur era on the Earth 65 million years ago. So with all of this importance that comets have had, it's fabulous that we finally have the chance to see an impact in action, to see something like this actually hit a planet. And fortunately, the planet isn't Earth, it's Jupiter this time.
Yeah, really, I'm glad it's very far away.
Yeah.
Well, this is going to be some crash. Give us a sense of the magnitude of the crash of this comet when it hits Jupiter.
Well, if you were to take all of Earth's nuclear weapons, everything that was owned by the former Soviet Union and the United States at the height of the Cold War, put them all in a box and light a match to it, and multiply the result by about 10,000 times, this is about what the energy we're talking about that will be released in the explosions this summer on Jupiter. So it's a major explosion. The bomb physicists are really excited about it. The comet scientists.
The nuclear bomb physicists expect to learn something from this crash?
Oh, yes. In fact, I guess the most famous one of all, Edward Teller, the inventor of the hydrogen bomb, immediately got really excited when he heard that this comet was hitting Jupiter. He's aware of how much energy is involved in the explosion of a comet. The reason that it's going to be so much is partly the size of the comet, but mostly the speed. It's coming down at about 60 kilometers per second, which means about 140,000 miles an hour. These comets are going to be hitting Jupiter at an enormous speed. And all that energy gets released all of a sudden, which means we're going to have a very large explosion. Unfortunately, we don't know how much of it we'll actually see, but there is a lot of energy that'll be released.
How big are these pieces of comet that will strike Jupiter?
That's the big mystery right now. Even though we've observed this comet so carefully with the Hubble Space Telescope, we have not been able to penetrate a thick cloud of dust that surrounds each of the comets. And so all we can do now is give an estimate. They're probably no smaller than about a half a mile across and probably no larger than about 2.5 miles across.
We should explain, this comet has basically broken up, so it's going to crash into Jupiter like it were a string of pearls. It's not going to be one crash, it's going to be a series of crashes.
Yeah, when we found the comet last March, it looked as if someone had stepped on it. In fact, Carolyn Shoemaker, in first seeing the image, said, "I don't know what this is, but it looks like a squashed comet, and it looks as if someone had stepped on it." And what had happened was that on July the 7th, 1992, this comet passed by Jupiter, so close to Jupiter, about 21,000, less than that, about 15,000 miles from the planet's cloud tops. The planet's gravity just reached up almost like a fist and yanked the comet into pieces, and it split it up into more than 20 pieces on that day.
Why are comets formed? Do they have any kind of cosmic function?
Well, comets were formed at the beginning of the solar system. There was a big continuum range of objects. The larger ones formed the planets. The smaller ones were these icy bodies that became the comets. Most of them, in the early years of the solar system, were swung away from this part of the solar system and moved into a new orbit way, way, way far from Earth. We call this the Oort cloud, O-O-R-T, after Jan Oort, the Dutch astronomer who postulated it. And it consists of many millions of comets very far from the Earth. And every now and then a passing star will knock a few of them in orbits that take them back closer to the Earth again. And this is what we think might have happened with Shoemaker-Levy 9.
Now, Jupiter is a gaseous planet like the Sun, but it's much cooler than the Sun. So what happens when a comet crashes into a gaseous planet? It's got to be different than, say, if it hit Earth, a solid mass.
Oh, yes. A comet like this hitting the Earth would make a very large crater in the ground. It would gouge out an enormous area of land. The dinosaur comet 65 million years ago created a hole in the ground that was about 150 miles wide, and it did all that in just a few seconds. This one, though, is hitting Jupiter, which, as you say, is a gas planet, but it's very cold gas. The comets are going to come into this cold gas that has about the consistency of frozen jello. So it's not going to be able to go right through it. It's going to reach a very heavy area of gas and then simply explode in that. The gas is really very cold. It's not in any danger of igniting because hydrogen, even though there's a lot of hydrogen gas, hydrogen needs oxygen in which to ignite, and there isn't any oxygen on Jupiter. So we know that it's different from landing on the Earth, but we really don't know how it's different, and we don't know how long the effects, like any storms that might form in Jupiter's atmosphere, might last. All we know is that there's an awful lot of energy that will be released in a very short time, more than we've ever seen before in our solar system.
Jupiter is the largest planet in the solar system. What else should we know about Jupiter to really appreciate this event that's about to happen?
Well, Jupiter is the by far the largest planet in the solar system. In fact, it has 99% of the mass of the solar system, except for the Sun, is out there in Jupiter. Jupiter is kind of like the solar system's vacuum cleaner. If it weren't for Jupiter, we probably wouldn't be here on Earth today because the Earth would be getting hit by major dinosaur-killing comets every million years or so. It would happen so often that life would probably not have ever had a chance to evolve on Earth. But because there's Jupiter out there with its enormous gravity well, it just kind of cleans up the comets. Most of the comets that approach Jupiter go nearby, past Jupiter very quickly, and then escape from the solar system. So we have, it's kind of like how Voyager 2 and Voyager 1 passed Jupiter and picked up speed an awful lot and eventually escaped from the solar system. With a few of those comets, however, they do not escape from the solar system. They continue to go around Jupiter for a while, and as this one is showing us, they actually leave the solar system by hitting Jupiter. We think that the event that we're seeing next month is something that takes place perhaps once every 1,000 years. Maybe a little more often than that, maybe not quite as often as that, but it's a very rare event and something that we're really lucky that we're able to watch right now.
This is the first time we have equipment that can allow us to monitor to some extent what's happening in a crash of this magnitude. So what exactly will astronomers be able to see on Earth?
Well, that's
That's a good question, right? Nobody knows for sure.
Yeah, that's a real complicated question. Technically nothing, because our seed on Earth is behind a post.
Mm-hmm.
The comets are going to come up from the south, zip around the back end of the planet, disappear, and crash a few seconds later. However, there are a couple of really lucky things that we have in place. There's a large spacecraft called Galileo on its way to Jupiter, just happens to be in a position where it will be able to see all of the impacts directly. And we should be able to get beautiful pictures from Galileo that show the comets breaking up and smashing into the planet. It could be very spectacular. But the other good news is that less than a half hour after every impact, Jupiter's rapid rotation period will pull the planet around, pull the impact sites around, so that we will then will be able to see everything. We'll be able to see whatever is left after about half an hour, if any little storms have formed, any other effects on Jupiter. The moment of truth is July the 16th at night, when the first of the 21 fragments hits Jupiter. 20 minutes later, Jupiter's rotation moves the impact site so that we can see it. And every major telescope on Earth or in space that can look at Jupiter is going to be watching to see what happens. This is the largest campaign for a single astronomical event in the history of astronomy. It's a very exciting event to watch.
If it's a clear night in our listeners' neighborhoods, will we be able to see anything with our naked eyes?
No, Jupiter is not going to show any changes that dramatic. However, I recommend that people go out to look at Jupiter, because Jupiter is always fabulous to look at. With the naked eye, all you have to do is look in the southwest, high in the southwest in the early evening. You'll be able to see Jupiter there. With a pair of binoculars, especially if you lean against the wall of a house and point the binoculars up towards Jupiter to give them a little stability, then you might be able to see Jupiter's moons. These are the same moons that Galileo discovered in 1610 and for which he was almost tortured by the Inquisition. You can see those with binoculars. With the smallest of telescopes, you can see bands of lines of clouds around the equator of Jupiter. These are things that are always glorious to look at, and almost everyone does not have that experience of seeing how beautiful Jupiter is. So what I recommend is that you go out there with a telescope or with binoculars and look at Jupiter, just so that you be a part of what's happening out there in this important event in Jupiter's life. But then to come inside and watch the pictures from Hubble Space Telescope coming in on the television is the other way that you'll be able to see what's happening.
This is going to be really loud, isn't it, when the comet crash happens? Is there a way of registering the sound?
Well, there actually is, not so that you actually hear it, but through a type of telescope called a radio telescope, which gathers energy from what's happening in Jupiter. And we should be able to, in a way, hear, but I put the word "hear" in quotation marks, because it's not something we can actually hear over the long distance of space through which the sound would travel. Sound cannot travel in a vacuum, so it's not something we can hear directly. But maybe with a radio telescope, we'll be able to get something like that.
What are you hoping to learn from this crash?
Well, I think the first thing is that we want to learn about Jupiter. We have never been able to penetrate very far below the cloud deck on Jupiter. We know this is the biggest planet in the solar system. We don't know what lies underneath it. We expect that these impacts will create a seismic wave that'll travel through Jupiter, possibly bouncing right off the core. We've never detected the core, and it'll be really neat if we could detect that Jupiter has a core that's about the size of the Earth. The other thing is, we'd like to learn a little bit about what Jupiter's atmosphere is made of. We would like to learn, we've already learned an awful lot about how fragile comets are. You know, it's amazing how there could be objects in space that are as fragile as comets are. You can virtually, if you were to be walking on a comet, you could break a comet apart with your hands. They are hardly put together with anything at all. Probably they're not much stronger than a than if you had a sphere of water out in space and just sort of sitting there and not moving any place. The interesting thing, though, that it is amazing that something that fragile could last as long as it has. Comets have lasted since almost the very beginning of the solar system. So it'll be fabulous to learn about what keeps comets together and also what tears them apart.
David Levy is my guest. He's an astronomer who has discovered about 21 comets, including co-discovering the comet that we're talking about, the red comet that's about to crash into Jupiter. He's also the author of several books. His two new ones are called The Quest for Comets and Sky Watching. David, let's take a break and then we'll talk some more.
Sure.
This is Fresh Air. Back with astronomer David Levy. Will the Hubble Space Telescope play a role in this? There was such a long period when it was not functioning the way astronomers hoped. Is it back in shape? And will it help us?
Yes, Hubble Space Telescope is definitely back in shape. The astronauts' attempt to repair it last December was extremely successful. The telescope is doing everything we had ever hoped for it to do. It is a wonderful telescope. It is also capable of showing Jupiter almost as clearly as the Voyager spacecraft showed it. And we have this fabulous telescope that's only really been operating for a year, poised to show us an event on Jupiter that might take place once in 1,000 years. You can't believe what luck we're having. And the telescope is going to be spending a good deal of that week looking at Jupiter, just to see what kind of changes there have been in the planet since then.
What detail do you see exactly in a gaseous planet? It's not like you can see trees and lakes and houses and people.
No. Jupiter, you know, for those of us who saw the Voyager 2 pictures of Jupiter, Jupiter is like a Rembrandt painting. It's absolutely gorgeous, very rich colors, because the different parts of the atmosphere, depending on how high they are, display different colors. The blues are a little lower down in the atmosphere, and the whites are sort of in the intermediate layer in the atmosphere, and the reds, like the Great Red Spot, are kind of very high up in the atmosphere where things are really cold. And you can see these things from any telescope on Earth, really, even a small telescope. Jupiter is a very colorful planet.
Will there be any effects on Earth? Will our weather be changed? Will anything else happen?
No, not this time. We're lucky. We have a 500 million mile distance between Jupiter and the Earth right now, and all the effects are going to be confined to Jupiter. We're not going to have any. The only effect that it'll have on the Earth is just going to get everybody very excited about seeing something like this. It's really nice to know. You know, when we were in fourth grade and we took our geography class, and in the fourth grade they told us that the solar system was made 4.5 billion years ago. Well, now we know that it's not really true, that the solar system has never been finished. And this summer we're going to see, you and I are going to be able to see, a little bit of the solar system change. There'll be a comet that is not going to exist anymore, and Jupiter is going to have a little bit, it's going to be just a little bit different for a while. And so the solar system is really a work in progress. It's moving along very nicely, thank you, but it's not finished. And observing Jupiter at this time when it's undergoing such interesting changes should really be fascinating.
Where are you going to observe from?
I'm going to be in Washington, D.C. I get to use a large refractor telescope with a lens at the United States Naval Observatory. The Planetary Society is sponsoring a public observing night down there, and I'm going to get to be a part of that. There are public observing nights, by the way, in almost every city in the country. I think if you call your planetarium or museum, I know that Nature Company stores are having an awful lot of public observing sessions in conjunction with the impact. Local astronomy clubs will be having special star parties that we'll be able to go and take a look at Jupiter during that week. There should be a lot of opportunity to go out and enjoy the sight of Jupiter during this important week.
When you look ahead, what are your wildest hopes and your worst fears for disappointment?
It's not really... I can give you my wildest hopes. And that is, of course, that the comets are a lot larger than we suspected, and that they're going to come into Jupiter and cause a lot of interesting special effects. And of course, I could say that my fears are that Jupiter will take a look at these comets, will swallow them, will go gloop, and there won't be anything at all for us to see. But I think that's not the right way of looking at this event. The success of this event is not measured by the size of the special effects that we get. This is a fundamental event in the solar system, and anything that happens is going to be great. This is too important an event just to say, well, are the effects as good as they are in a movie theater? It's really an awe-inspiring thing we're seeing, and anything we see is going to be fabulous.
There's no chance this is going to have the Comet Kohoutek syndrome where everything fizzles at the last minute?
Comet Kohoutek, 1973. You know, that was predicted. They said it would be the comet of the century. And sure enough, comets have minds of their own, and the comet of the century got shy at the last minute, and very few people saw it. This is a very different kind of event from Comet Kohoutek. That was a comet. The only thing it needed to do was to get bright. And it didn't do that. This is a very different kind of event. This is an event in which a series of comets that has already been very exciting by splitting apart into 21 pieces are going to crash into Jupiter at 140,000 miles an hour. We have no idea what that's going to produce. It may show absolutely nothing. It may be quite exciting and showing new clouds and storms on Jupiter that last for a few weeks. We don't know what that'll do. But we do know that impacts are a major event in the solar system. They've shaped the course of life on Earth here, and they have shaped the building of the planets over the last 4.5 billion years. And the fact that we get to see one is really great. You know, it's almost as if the telephone rings and you pick it up and nature is at the other end of the line and nature says, listen, what I'm going to do here is I'm going to drop 21 comets into Jupiter at 140,000 miles an hour each. All I want you to do is watch. And we're being given this gift from nature, and all we have to do is watch it, and that we're going to do. Anything that happens is going to be exciting. This is definitely not a comet that could become bright or might not become bright. It is not Comet Kohoutek. This is a major fundamental event that we are watching, and it's going to be exciting no matter what happens.
David Levy recorded a couple of weeks ago. He co-discovered the comet that begins crashing into Jupiter tomorrow. You can see some of the images of the crash on a program called The Great Comet Crash, July 20th, on many public TV stations. Levy's latest books are A Quest for Comets and Sky Watching. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Here's Sun Ra performing Friendly Galaxy.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up on this archive edition of Fresh Air, we celebrate the 25th anniversary of the Apollo moonwalk. General Chuck Yeager was the first man to fly faster than the speed of sound. He was never an astronaut, but he helped make space travel possible. We'll feature a 1988 interview with him. And we'll feature a recent interview with the first American in space, Alan Shepard. His first flight was in 1961 and lasted only 15 minutes. When he landed on the moon 10 years later, he wasn't the first American there, but he was the first man to hit a golf ball on the moon. Also, film critic Stephen Schiff reviews True Lies, starring Arnold Schwarzenegger and Jamie Lee Curtis. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. President Clinton will host a summit meeting July 25th between Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin and King Hussein of Jordan. The two countries are moving toward a peace treaty, and even though it might not be ready in time, the meeting should advance Middle East peace prospects and improve the president's image. Barry Schwein has more.
King Hussein of Jordan has declined for decades to formalize the de facto peace between his kingdom and Israel. But he told his parliament last Saturday he would not wait for others if it served his country's interests to move ahead. Israeli and Jordanian negotiators already have a framework peace treaty worked out. They are putting finishing touches on their borders and other arrangements. Bringing the King and Rabin to Washington enhances President Clinton's image as a peacemaker and also could be just enough to close the deal. The administration is helping Jordan's economy by forgiving more than $650 million in debts and will provide other aid for the twin reasons of advancing peace in the Middle East and also embellishing the U.S. role in peacemaking. For National Public Radio, this is Barry Schwein at the State Department.
Diplomats of the European Union say they've chosen Luxembourg's Prime Minister Jacques Santer as the new president of the EU. The EU leaders had deadlocked on a new leader at a recent summit in Corfu, Greece. They're looking for a successor to Jacques Delors. 11 EU countries had already decided to support Belgian Premier Jean-Luc Dehaene during the Corfu conference. But British Prime Minister John Major vetoed the choice, saying Dehaene was too enthusiastic about European integration. Diplomats must make a unanimous choice for a leader. Rwandans fleeing their country in fear of advancing Rwandan rebels are overwhelming border towns in Zaire. The BBC's Lindsay Hilsum says the exodus is incredible.
Aid agencies say that about 800,000 Rwandans will have arrived in Goma by the end of today. Thousands are streaming over the border now, and the town of Gisenyi, where the rump Rwandan government has been based, is reported to be full of people, all desperate to cross the border into Zaire as the Rwandan Patriotic Front approaches. In Goma, Rwandans are thronging the streets. The roundabouts have become temporary camps. There are vehicles everywhere, piled high with mattresses and suitcases. Cows are wandering amongst the people. The local population is stunned. One Zairean man said he'd been woken at 3 o'clock this morning to find several hundred Rwandans camped just outside his house.
Lindsay Hilsum reporting. Mexican President Carlos Salinas says the investigation into the assassination of presidential candidate Luis Donaldo Colosio will stay open. He's made the decision despite an investigator's conclusion Colosio was killed by a lone gunman. On Wall Street, stock prices moved up. The Dow gained 14.5 points to end the day at 3,753. This is NPR. The White House says President Clinton has approved even tighter sanctions against Haiti. The administration says Mr. Clinton has signed an order authorizing U.S. helicopters to stop the flow of goods across the border between Haiti and the Dominican Republic. The move comes with growing speculation that the U.S. could invade Haiti to topple the ruling Haitian military leaders. The USS Mount Whitney is now sailing for Haitian waters. This ship is designed as a command vessel, which could direct military action against Haiti if necessary. The Russian parliament today passed a resolution condemning the U.S. Senate for its decision to tie continuing U.S. aid to Russia to the final withdrawal of Russian troops from Estonia. NPR's Mike Schuster reports from Moscow.
Interference in the internal affairs of Russia, cried the Duma, the lower house of the parliament, adding, it's a disruption of good relations between Estonia and Russia. One member of the Duma, Vladimir Lukin, former Russian ambassador to the U.S., was quoted as calling the Senate's action either stupid or provocative. On Wednesday, the Senate adopted a resolution linking hundreds of millions of dollars in U.S. aid to Russia to a final pullout of Russian troops from Estonia on August 31st. Russia is withdrawing its last troops from both Germany and Latvia on that date. But last weekend in Italy, President Boris Yeltsin said he would not pull out his remaining 2,500 troops in Estonia at that time. Russia wants Estonia to provide residence permits for all retired Russian soldiers living there, a measure Estonia has refused to take. Russia says it does intend to withdraw from Estonia, but will not commit to the August 31st deadline. I'm Mike Schuster in Moscow.
North Korea seems to be returning to normal after the death of its leader, Kim Il-sung. The North has criticized South Korea's government. The North denounced the South for putting its military on alert for 6 days after Kim died. The North says this was rude and without morals. Meanwhile, South Korean war veterans are rallying against sending condolences to Kim, who launched the Korean War. I'm Korva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Wednesday is the 25th anniversary of the first moonwalk. General Chuck Yeager was never an astronaut, but he helped make space travel possible. He was the first person to travel faster than the speed of sound. Yeager was a fighter pilot in World War II. After surviving many dogfights, he took another risky job, testing high-performance aircraft. He rapidly earned the reputation of America's top test pilot. He broke the sound barrier October 14, 1947, in an X-1 aircraft, which he rode 40,000 feet high, traveling over 660 miles per hour. In 1953, he established a world speed record of 1,650 miles per hour in an X-1A plane. Tom Wolfe called Yeager the most righteous of all the possessors of the right stuff. In 1988, I asked Yeager if he was seated in a comfortable position when he broke the sound barrier.
Well, no, it was very uncomfortable, and the reason was we had no source of power in the X-1. We used compressed nitrogen gas to do all the work, like raise and lower the gear and pressurize the liquid oxygen tanks, which, incidentally, they had no seat in the X-1. You sat with your back against the bulkhead, which contained the liquid oxygen, and the temperature of the liquid oxygen was 290 degrees below zero, and it was one of the coldest cockpits I've ever been in my life. And you sat on the floor, and your knees were higher than your rear end, so you could pull high G's without blacking out. And you couldn't see too well out of it, but you got to remember, it was a research airplane, and it was built in 1944. So.
It really does sound very uncomfortable from the way you're
describing
it.
Well, it was, but, you know, you sat in the thing almost an hour, but it kept you awake, that's for sure.
Right. Well, when you were flying it, what indications would you have? What kind of meters would tell you when you had actually broken the sound barrier?
Well, I had an altimeter that told me how high I was. I had an indicated airspeed and that told me how fast I was going through the air in miles per hour. But the one thing that we relied on was a Mach meter that told us what our percentage was in relationship to the speed of sound. For instance, Mach 1 is the speed of sound at the altitude you're flying. And if you're going 0.9 Mach, that's 90% of the speed of sound. Because, see, an airplane responds to the effects of the speed of sound, like or shock waves on the airplane, so you're only interested in your percentage of the speed of sound or the Mach number that you're going. I had a Mach meter that went up to 1.0, and the day that I actually broke Mach 1, I sat there and watched that Mach meter build up, you know, since we'd been up to about 0.94 or 0.95 Mach number on the previous flight, and I watched it build up, and when it got up to about 0.96, and then that buffeting was quite heavy on the airplane, was shaking pretty bad. But then at that point, the Mach meter went off the scale, and if I extrapolated, you know, it'd be about 1.06, but the Mach meter only went to 1.0. But when it did, all the buffeting smoothed out, which was an indication that we had, you know, supersonic flow over the whole airplane, meaning that it was flying at supersonic speeds. And when this happened, we made the first sonic boom there at Edwards, and that's about the way it happened.
When you realized that you'd broken the speed of sound, that your mission was accomplished, did you stay up in the air a while and just have a good time and celebrate?
I didn't have. No, you can't stay up because, see, a rocket, you burn out all of your fuel. It only had to last 2.5 minutes, and then you're gliding down to make a dead stick landing on Rogers Dry Lake out there at Edwards or then Muroc Air Base. But I was elated. I did a couple of rolls, and when I got down, since I was pretty well beat up from a horseback riding accident a couple of days before, I was kind of bushed. And also, you're sitting in that cold airplane, you really get cold soaked, and it's good to get out into the warm sun. And, you know, and also their program was classified, so it's not exactly as the film The Right Stuff depicts it, but we knew it was classified, and just a couple, three of us had a little party that night. I mean, big party, if you want to call it that.
Well, because it was classified, you even had to speak in code in your radio communications while you were in flight.
Ridley and I knew what we were doing, and, you know, you really don't say a heck of a lot anyway when you're flying.
What were the reasons for classifying it? Why was it so top secret?
Because of what we found out. And the reason was, if you recall, once we got into the region of the speed of sound, we lost our elevator effectiveness. Now, Terry, this may get a little technical, but all airplanes, light airplanes, if you looked at them, they have a horizontal stabilizer or a tail, and on the trailing edge of that horizontal stabilizer and the elevators or flippers. And when you move the control stick back, that elevator goes up, and that's what controls the attitude of your airplane. It makes the nose go up or go down. And when we got into up to about 0.93 Mach number, or 93% of the speed of sound, we lost the effectiveness of that elevator on the X-1, and we couldn't control our airplane. But we had built a capability into the X-1 of moving the whole horizontal stabilizer or tailplane, and we found out that, lo and behold, we could control the X-1 through Mach 1 with that horizontal stabilizer. Now, it was interesting to me, when that happened, we found that out. Then, of course, we started building flying tails on our airplanes, that our combat airplanes that were built 3 or 4 years later. And it was amusing to me to find out that the British and the French and the Soviet Union didn't find out that little trick for 5 years. That was the reason it was classified, and mm-hmm. rightly so.
How else did breaking the sound barrier change aviation?
Well, it opened up space to us. Up until that time, you recall, we would never had an airplane out beyond the speed of sound, and we didn't know what problems we would run into, and that flying tail that I mentioned is one of the secrets we found out that solved a lot of problems. We also developed higher thrust engines that could drive fighter aircraft or operational aircraft through the speed of sound. Once we got beyond the speed of sound, then there's no other barriers other than heat, and that opened up space for us.
Chuck Yeager, recorded in 1988. Coming up, we meet astronaut Alan Shepard. This is Fresh Air. Alan Shepard was the first American in space. In 1961, he rode the space capsule Mercury 7 to an altitude of 115 miles. 10 years later, Shepard commanded the Apollo 14 on a mission to the moon. In between those two space flights, he was grounded for medical reasons, but he helped direct the space program as chief of NASA's astronaut office. He was an essential part of the team that helped America first get to the moon 25 years ago. Last month, I asked him about his first space flight back in 1961. The trip was brief, so we didn't have much time to experiment with weightlessness.
My flight was only 16 minutes. We did have about 5.5 minutes of weightlessness, and the thing which we tried to cram into that 5.5 minutes had to do primarily with my ability to actually control the spacecraft, actually fly it like an airplane. Because we knew that so much of the early days of space depended upon the abilities of a pilot, not only under primary conditions with no casualties, no failures, but also to practice for situations where the pilot would have to take over in order to bring it back in safely. So most of the 5.5 minutes were devoted to my actually controlling the spacecraft and reporting how I was doing and that sort of thing.
How were you doing?
I did great, of course. I would.
I mean, how did it feel to control the spacecraft while being weightless?
Well, it was a tremendous exhilaration, of course, at being up there in the first place. Also, the second place, the fact that everything was going well. And then, lastly, the fact that I flew it exactly as I was supposed to fly it.
You were grounded for several years because of an inner ear problem. And then you were able to be cured through a surgical process that surprised everybody by working and working very well. So then you got to go to the moon, which you'd long wanted to do. But when you took that flight, the Apollo 14, in 1971, February of 1971, you felt that you carried the whole future of the space program with you. Why did your mission have such symbolic import?
Well, that's kind of an interesting story, actually. As soon as I was ungrounded and NASA said, okay, we think you're ready to go, Slayton and I immediately picked a crew and gave me command of Apollo 13. We sent the list to Washington. They said, oh, we can't do that. We said, now, wait a minute, you know, Shepard has been training along with everybody. He's just as bright and just as ready to go as the rest of them. How come? They said, well, it's just too soon. You give us a political problem. Shepard is so well known, and he's been obviously grounded for so many years, and politically, it's just not right. So let's make a deal. Give us another crew for Apollo 13, and we'll let Shepard have 14. So, as you may recall, Apollo 13 took off with Jim Lovell and Fred Hayes and Jack Swigert. They're halfway on the way to the moon, and they had an explosion which blew out the side of the service module, the mothership. It took away all their primary power system, and there they were on the way to the moon without the power to do it. Obviously, they weren't going to be able to land. They used the lunar module power systems to communicate, to help navigate, and with the help of the people on the ground, of course, it did a fantastic job and came back safely. But then the next flight, all of a sudden, is under the gun. It said, well, yeah, we made a couple of landings, but we had an explosion. Do we really need to keep doing this? Don't we have enough rocks the way it is? So there was starting to be criticism of the program as a result of the explosion. Then there was the fact that the two chaps I had chosen to go with me had not flown before, and my buddies didn't give me a heck of a lot of credit for just 16 minutes of spaceflight, so we were dubbed the Three Rookies, Apollo 14, the Three Rookies, and that put a little bit of added interest. It gave us a little bit of additional incentive to absolutely fly the very best flight that had ever been flown before or since. And quite frankly, we came very close to that.
What surprised you most about how the surface of the moon looked?
I don't think we had any surprises about the actual surface of the moon, about the barrenness. We had looked at pictures of our landing site taken by previous missions. We had worked with the models that were made from those pictures. We knew the general configuration of where the craters were supposed to be. We knew the objective of Cone Crater, which was the one we climbed up the side of to get rock samples. There weren't any surprises there. The surprise I had was standing on the surface after we'd been there for a few minutes, having a chance to rest a little bit and looking up at the Earth for the first time. Now, you have to look up because that's where it is, and the sky is totally black, and here you have a planet which is four times the size of the moon as we look at it from the Earth, and you also have a color. You have a blue oceans and the brown land masses, the brown continents, and you can see ice on the ice caps on the North Pole and so on, and just an absolute incredible view. And then you say, hey, that looks a little small to me. It looks like it does have limits. It's a little fragile. You know, down here we think it's infinite. We don't worry about resources. Up there you're saying, gosh, you know, it's a shame those folks down there can't get along together and think about trying to conserve, to save what limited resources they have. And it was just very, very emotional. I actually shed a couple of tears looking up at the Earth and having those feelings.
One of the things you did on the moon was to hit a couple of golf balls. Where did the golf club come from and the golf balls? And why'd you do it?
Well, I enjoyed the game of golf before I went, and I tried to think of something that would demonstrate the fact we only had 1/6 gravity. which means the ball is going to go six times as far for the same club head speed. There's no atmosphere, so the ball is not going to hook or slice. And the time of flight is going to be six times as long. So I started thinking about it and very quickly realized that we had a collapsible handle there, aluminum handle, we used with a scoop on the end. And we used that to scoop up samples of dust, and we put them in a little bag and mark the bag and bring it back. We use that because it's very difficult to bend over and get a sample from a virgin dust. But that would have been left up there, so I took a look at it, and it was about the same as the length of a shaft of a number six iron. So I got the head of a number six and cut it off and put a little fitting, had a pro put a little fitting on it to snap on the end of this club. And I had the club head and the two golf balls in the pocket of my suit. I had practiced before we went. I got the boss's permission to do it. And at the very end of the mission, when all was completed, I snapped the club head on the handle, tossed the two golf balls down in the dust, kind of teed them up a little bit, and took a whack and did it in front of the television camera. So we have a great picture in the book of this ball sailing up and off into the black sky. The suit was kind of cumbersome, and I couldn't swing as hard as I wanted, so it probably would have gone maybe 30, 35 yards with one hand shot here on the earth, but it went over 200 yards. The time of flight was like 40 seconds. Just absolute thrill for me to do that. And in the book, you actually see the picture of the golf ball still in the frame, which is kind of cute.
Alan Shepard recorded last month. He co-authored the new book, Moonshot. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, what do you have about Haiti?
Well, we have, among other things today, an informal debate on the subject of whether the U.S. should intervene militarily in Haiti. New York Democratic Congressman Charles Rangel says the U.S. should use military force to restore President Aristide to power in Haiti. Republican Senator John McCain of Arizona says we should not, that we have intervened in Haiti before, did them no good, and while we could do it all in 6 hours, he said, it would take us a lot longer than that to get out. Also on today's program, we'll be hearing about the announced summit for the week after next in Washington involving Israel and Jordan.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Arnold Schwarzenegger and writer-director James Cameron have proved to be one of the most potent combinations in box office history, first with The Terminator in 1984, which made both of them big stars, then with Terminator 2, Judgment Day, which in 1991 was the most expensive movie ever made. The new Schwarzenegger-Cameron blockbuster cost even more, $120 million. Is the money on the screen? Film critic Stephen Schiff reviews True Lies.
The money is on the screen, and that's part of the problem. For long stretches of True Lies, all you see up there is money. Bigger explosions, more bullets, heftier fight scenes, noisier chases. The mind glazes over. And yet Cameron, who wrote his own screenplay, never stops being inventive. Just when you think you've seen enough spitting machine guns to last a lifetime, he'll send one bumping pokily down a staircase, wiping out legions of bad guys every time it hits another step. In other words, as much as Cameron adores large-scale pyrotechnics, he also knows the value of small-scale wit. What he doesn't know is quite how to weave the two together. True Lies, in fact, is about that very problem. Arnold Schwarzenegger plays secret agent Harry Tasker, and Harry kicks off the movie with a fiery 15-minute demonstration of James Bond-style derring-do, only to trundle home to his plain vanilla suburban wife. She's played by Jamie Lee Curtis, and she greets him calmly as she brushes her teeth, thinking her dull, distracted husband has been up to something else entirely.
How'd it go at the convention? Did you make all the other salesmen jealous?
Oh, it was fantastic. You wouldn't believe it. You should have been there. We were the big hit of the show. We did new model ordering system, the 680 I told you about. I can write up an order, and immediately as soon as the customer's name comes up, you see what his credit line is, what he has ordered in the past, what discount he has gotten, every little detail.
Perfect.
It's fantastic. So I love the computer business.
Listen, the plumber called. He says he has to dig under the slab or something that's going to cost $600.
That's okay.
Well, it's not okay. It's extortion.
So what do you tell him?
I slept with him and he said he'd knock off $100.
That's good thinking. Bye, honey.
Cameron had a choice here. He could have played up the action and placed his premise about the husband keeping his secret life secret in the background. That would have appealed to his young male audience. But Hollywood is becoming increasingly aware of the power of the not-so-young female audience. Recent surveys have indicated that the single largest American ticket-buying group is women in their 20s and early 30s. To speak to them, Cameron decided to give serious attention to the strain Harry's clandestine life puts on his marriage. And it's a good thing, too. The movie has a long and enjoyable midsection in which Harry suspects that his wife is having an affair and deploys all the methods of a top secret agent to, well, discover her secret. But when Cameron gets back to the heavy-duty action, complete with Harrier jets and nuclear explosions, the movie feels tired and overblown. Still, you can have a lot of fun at True Lies. There are even a few surprises. Tom Arnold, for instance, plays Harry's sidekick and proves that this pairing of Arnold and Arnold is much more winning than that other one. Jamie Lee Curtis is very funny as she blossoms from Mouseburger to Red Hot Mama under her husband's astonished gaze, and Schwarzenegger himself, in his first screen appearance as an actual human since 1990, almost convinces you that he is one. Now the only question is, was the creation of these admittedly mild pleasures really worth more or less the entire gross national product of Equatorial Guinea?
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for The New Yorker. Our intern Marcus Tossig is moving on. We wish him good luck and thank him for his fine work. It's a tough day for people like me who hate to say goodbye. Our inveterate production assistant, Nancy Greenlease, is leaving us to attend the Columbia University Graduate School of Journalism. If Fresh Air were an accredited institution, we would be awarding her an advanced degree in editing tape under deadline with an enviable amount of intelligence, grace, and good humor. But try putting that on a resume. Good luck from all of us. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.